Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
Welcome. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm in studio today with Stefan Hosteter and Deirdre Leonauta. Did I get it? Oh, I'm so close. Correct me.
So close. Deirdre Leonauta.
One of these weeks I'll get it, Deirdre. One of these weeks. So we're going to get right down to it. This week I absolutely drowned my co-hosts with news links. There's a ton of stuff going on, and that's not even including, of course, all the other world-breaking news and things that we would love to talk about if we had a 12-hour show. But we will leave the professional pundits to talk about the other news and get on with our urgent environment news for now, although stay tuned for the bonus show, possibly for some comments on other things. But without any other distraction, let's get right down to it. We got a lot. Stefan, what's going on?
Yeah, thank you, Darren. So this is one of those stories that we come across our desk every once in a while, which is when you read it, it could have been, you know, it could be the formation of a long think piece, but we've been talking about it for so many times that I feel like it would just be boring for our listeners to hear us go through the entire thing all over again. I've done some extra digging and actually tried to find some other pieces to make this all interesting. And what we're referencing is an internal memo to the Deputy Minister of Finance, which basically showed that the amount of excess capacity that exists within our pipelines currently basically means that we don't need any more pipelines at least until 2025. Is this memo that was sent to the Deputy Minister of Finance that our current capacity is relatively good enough? The amount it would save or be able to lower the cost per barrel is minute. And so the argument basically is it's not really worth it. So you can take your time and chill is sort of the response to the Trudeau government. I'm always interested in the news stories we cover that we get the news links from things like the finance department, like the finance section. Whenever the finance section is the piece that we're getting news from, I'm always interested in those stories.
Well, it's funny. It's like because they figure that they'll hide it where no one will read it, I think.
Well, but also I think I think more so it's deemed not interesting to anyone unless you're following that kind of thing.
Right.
You know, it's not deemed interesting unless you are really going to be, you know, trading in oil futures. And so that's who should be paying attention to this. But of course, we've been sort of going on and harping on this case for a while. We've been. I even think like 2 weeks ago we had a whole rant about how the price of oil doesn't make any sense right now.
2 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago,
exactly.
5 weeks ago,
exactly. So what I tried to do to actually get us some more interesting facts on this was I tried to look into some of the other things about the price of oil and when Canada should be considering the value of the price of oil. And it comes from a couple different articles. The first is an analysis from Deloitte, which says that basically oil is trading at around $44 this year. In their arguments, it would climb to $55 per barrel in the United States currency by 2018, $7 a barrel by 2020, and $80 a barrel by 2022. But that's what's interesting about this is the report was called cautiously optimistic to the possibility of increased oil price, saying that, and this is a quote, globally, demand continues to lag supply. But the renewed OPEC production freeze talks and recent boosts in crude imports to Asia offer positive signs that the surplus is beginning to shrink. And what's interesting about this is that this was a report a couple months ago, and those OPEC production freeze talks fell through. They did not happen, or they did not succeed, which means that the price of oil is going that at least that one piece of the decrease to increase the price of oil is actually not currently happening. And the second part, of course, is the recent boost in crude imports to Asia, which is, I think, the bigger part. I think whenever oil companies or oil executives come out and say things like, this is going to, like, oil production will not steady, will increase for the foreseeable future, they're really relying on emerging markets of, like, China and India to share the brunt of that increased oil use. And so the other part of this is how much money the Canadian, like, basically, it's very expensive or quite expensive to refine, or not to refine oil, to the oil basically comes out of Canada has to have a pretty high cost. And so I was looking into that. And basically, Canada crude breaks even point around $35 to $40 a barrel, which is about close to 2 times what you get out of, you know, the really, really great wells in Saudi Arabia. Their break-even point is around $20. But what that means is basically right now, per barrel, Canada is making approximately $4 a barrel. Compared to at the peak of oil production and oil expansion, you were looking at $100 barrel oil. So they're making incredible amounts of money, which is part why you see actually the decrease in production.
And just to be clear on that $4 stuff, and do you mean $4 like Canada, like Canadian taxpayers not getting $4
a
barrel?
No.
These are quote unquote Canadian companies making $4.
Well, yeah, these are oil sands companies. Right. Yeah, exactly. Now they're not even quote unquote Canadian. You know, half of them are owned by outside organizations.
And has been pointed out to me by trolls on Twitter before. Yes, some of them are entirely owned by Canadians. Very few, and those ones suck too.
Yeah, like it's not an important piece of this of the equation. Whether or not it's a Canadian company who owns this in the end doesn't change the royalties they're paying to Alberta. It doesn't change the taxes that are going that way.
It also has no impact whatsoever on the price of gas we pay here in Canada.
Yes.
If I have to say that every week for the next 10 years, I will. The amount of oil that we export in Canada has basically zero impact.
It has zero impact.
Well, in the sense that you're throwing pennies on a pile, on a Scrooge McDuck size pile of pennies, of which an average is taken. So, I mean, to the millionths of a cent, yes, it does.
Sure, but of course, the funny thing about that, of course, is that when it's the cheapest possible, like it is currently, right. What we're actually seeing, these are people describing the amount of oil we have as a glut. Like, we currently have way more oil and finding more oil than we're using at this current moment, mm-hmm. and we're still expanding to try to find more production, which is all to put into contrast this entire conversation about pipelines, right? That's the whole point of this, is that we're in this scenario where we're having this conversation about whether or not we should build this pipeline or that pipeline and how and where we should do it, while that isn't obviously not causing any actual impact. Isn't actually, or is devoid of the current reality we live in, I guess is more accurate.
Yeah.
The current reality we live in is that, you know, per barrel of oil, we're making almost no money. And the only reason they're still doing it is because infrastructure already exists.
Yeah.
More and more of these oil production wells that are being built around the rest of the oil sands are being shut down because they're or being canceled, not being built because of these facts. And yet we're still having this conversation like pipelines are going to change things.
Yeah. Now, like Stefan, a reasonable person might say to you. In fact, some listener may be listening to you right now and saying, "Well, Stefan, come on now." Come on now, you silly, crazy lefty. If that were true, why would they be building pipelines?
Right. Well, and that's the thing, right? Is that the idea is that you'll still be making – that they're being built on the idea that the oil will go back up.
Yeah,
right? They're being built on the idea that oil prices will return. That's the whole idea.
On that, and I think there's one more other important point. But you know what? I'll go second. Deirdre, go ahead.
No, what I found interesting was the fact that that article said that oil companies sometimes relied on the low oil prices to kind of drive the market and end up raising the price. But because we're moving towards an economy that doesn't rely on oil, that probably won't happen. And I think that we're probably – those companies are pushing these pipelines just kind of out of principle because the argument has gone on for so long now that – they kind of can't lose now.
because
just look really bad.
No, I was going to say something similar, but I would actually go farther. Because if you get the Canadian government to buy into a policy of building pipelines, whether or not they're necessary, what you're doing is you're putting the Canadian government in the position to have to defend those pipelines, which means that you're taking money away from renewable energy projects. So every dollar they can get approved to be spent, and every piece of land that can be partitioned, every deal that can be struck, every union pipeline company that can be can be brought on board because they're going to get money are all people who are now going to help them fight against renewable energy. And that's where the buck stops. They don't need it, but they're not going to lose money. They're just not going to make any money. What they are going to do is screw over every competitor by getting Canada as a country federally to buy into pipelines. And that is the end game. This has nothing to do with dollars and cents. In the short term, profit per oil, this has everything to do with setting Canadian federal policy going forward.
I might not go as far as saying the goal is to kill renewable energy, but I do think it's a very interesting that both of you sort of touched on.
Let me replace that with suppress.
All right, fair enough. But I think what both of you are touching on, which I think actually is a very fascinating piece of this, is that oil companies see each lost pipeline as a buffer to their loss of social contract. They for so long the oil companies had in unlimited social contract. They could do whatever they want. They had all this power. And each time they lose one of these pipeline battles, it is proof that they're losing that. And I think they need a win. I think, mm-hmm. quite honestly, I think the oil companies are seeing this as they need a win to prove that they're still relevant. And because if they can't get any pipelines built, it's further and further proof that they are no longer, or they're slowly becoming irrelevant.
Yeah, you know how they could be relevant? By switching from oil companies to energy companies and pioneering the new renewable market.
Yeah.
It might actually be cheaper and better for Canada just to build the pipelines and then flush a whole bunch of money down them and just throw that at the U.S. It might actually be cheaper.
Yeah, exactly. There's just so much about this. So much of it gets stuck to, I think, the way people are thinking about this entire endeavor. And I think Deirdre's right that when we're seeing some oil companies actually doing this, creating some of that shift, and that ends up being the most profitable piece of their arm. And yet they still get stuck in this idea that they have to go back to this, what they understand, the bread and butter, because there's just such an old stock Canadian sort of belief, to steal another Stephen Harper line for my nefarious purposes.
Yeah.
But this carries on to the next story, which is, again, also has to do with pipelines. And it has to do with this one annoys me a little bit, but it's an iPolitics article for the case for refining bitumen in Canada. And basically, it's trying to make the case that, and it's true that it does seem that this is half of this is at least true, that the Green Party of Canada and also at least one indigenous chief have said in the past that they would be okay with pipelines if it was refined bitumen rather than oil sands bitumen. That the real issue is that we're shipping this incredibly dirty that it's the type of oil sludge that we're shipping that's the real concern, and that if you refine it in Canada, that would keep jobs in Canada, and then also. And also mean that we're not sending this sort of sludge through the pipelines instead of sending regular or cleaner oil, and their point is that if we can do that, we can get everyone on side and everyone will be happy, and it's just ridiculous.
And it should be pointed out that post, the reason I saw that post, Stefan, was that it was being shared directly from Elizabeth May's personal account. So this is not some sort of backbencher. This is not a rumor. This is not something put on them. Elizabeth May herself was promoting this concept. And I'd like to, I have a comment on that, but I'd actually like to hear both of your comments on that first.
I think
the simple fact that she herself is promoting that this is the way forward.
Yeah. I don't know. I would like to hear her exact opinion on it rather than just sort of sharing it. Like, I'd like to hear her actually speak on it because she's, you know, very well spoken. But to me, this harkens back to, I think, my fundamental critique of old conservative environmentalism, like conservationist environmentalism, where the major thing you have to be concerned about was that your pristine land might be hurt. Rather than the new environmentalism, which has this much larger, wider context and opinion on it, and I find it so fascinating that there's this whole piece of this that the Green Party is apparently willing to give up. Like, I don't understand how refining oil in Canada does not make it the pipelines have a better chance of passing a climate test. That doesn't change anything.
No. Well, their argument, and directly from Ms. May's post, and I'll be happy to link to, she didn't speak on it, but there was a post with the share. And what was said there was that the primary concern was that essentially, it wasn't said, but it was implied, there's no way we're going to stop all the pipelines. And so the best way forward is to minimize the danger from risks. And there was in her own post, in her own words, talk about how refined bitumen is much easier to clean up and has like significantly lower environmental impacts. And essentially, the argument seemed to be implying that, you know, we're not going to win completely, and so we have to get on board with a type of win, which would be to reduce harm. So just to clarify that, I do have a comment, but I'll wait for the rest of you guys to finish on that.
I think it's definitely the Green Party trying to compromise. I know Elizabeth May is an incredibly smart woman, but maybe they've gotten to a point where they have to look at another side. But for me, yeah, I'm also coming from the perspective that it's not about the type of oil that's going through the pipeline. It's for me, it's more about the source of that oil. And if it's coming from the oil sands, then it's not really going to help anything, because the oil sands themselves are a huge part of the problem. And if that oil is coming from the oil sands, then it's not going to have that much effect. For me, well, anyway.
Yeah, what I don't understand about this is the only way this is better is that if it spills, it will do less harm.
Yeah.
That is the only way. It doesn't. None of this reduces the carbon being emitted. None of this reduces anything. The only reason it is in any way better is that it is not shipping that kind of that if it spills, it's less dangerous.
If it spills on Canadian soil, it will be easier to clean up and less damaging. Yes.
Yeah. Which like
and at least Canadians will be getting money out of it.
Like and to me that's the least of our concerns. Yeah. That's the least of our concerns. Like the problem with the oil sands is that it fuels a carbon economy that we cannot be a part of. And if anything, this is building more oil infrastructure. This is building infrastructure to carry on this practice for even longer. And the idea that's a thing we should focus on is ludicrous.
All right. So just really quickly on this, because I want to squeeze one more thing in, and then we'll go to a break real quick. So I have a three-dimensional chess analysis, and I have a completely cynical analysis. Let's go with cynicism first. The cynicism answer is that the Green Party, you know, you cannot be both an activist. You cannot be perfect activist and a perfect politician simultaneously. It's like the idea of perfect mercy and justice. You cannot be both perfectly just and merciful, because mercy is a suspension of justice by definition. And I think that activism is a suspension of politics by definition in the same manner. So, you know, Elizabeth May has to be a politician first. That's her job. And her job is to get green people elected. Not like first and foremost is to get Green Party members elected. That is her primary job. And through that, hopefully good environmental change will come. So the cynical answer is that this is simply a potentially tactful political move to increase the perceived legitimacy of the Green Party in the eyes of Canadians, to further getting green people elected and therefore have a bigger influence on policy. What's my three-dimensional chess answer? My three-dimensional chess answer is that, and I don't believe this to be true, but it would be hilarious and it's not entirely unfeasible, is that by getting them to agree to this as some sort of like, oh good, you can get the environmentalists off our backs if we agree to this plan, and then there's no way it will ever financially make sense, and this could be like, you know, tricking them into essentially committing harikari.
Right.
I think the first one is far more likely, but the second one's impossible.
Right. Well, it is true. What's interesting about this, of course, is what's fascinating about this is that the argument against it from all the economists or all the oil industry is that it's not financially viable to do this. It doesn't make sense, which is a reasonable response. It was like if you're living in the world, which is what I find interesting, right, is if you're living in a world where you're trying to find the cheapest way to do this, you might as well do it where you already have some infrastructure built up, which is part of, but at the same time, if you're living in a world where finance matters, we've already sort of seen this in the last 20 minutes. We've already talked that oil sands production right now barely makes sense in the first place. And if we succeed in what the Green Party's entire mandate is to do, which is transform ourselves into a low carbon economy, the oil sands will make progressively less sense in the future. So it's the whole thing is kind of silly. But Darren, you wanted to actually get one more thing in. So let's throw you.
No. Well, what I was going to say was, we're good for a break now. So I was going to say, was there one more thing you wanted to get to in this section, or would you kindly preview the next section? section, and then I'll introduce our music break.
Yeah, yeah. So I think we're good. I think the next section that we're going to cover is all about U.S. politics. So we're going to talk a little bit about whether or not Hillary Clinton can run on the strongest climate change platform ever, whether or not climate change will ever matter in the U.S. politics or in the world generally, and then maybe if we have time in the next section, we might also cover climate change denial funding, and if not, we'll be sure to get that in the third section. So at least some point in the rest of the show, we'll get to climate change denial funding.
All right. So as you may have noticed, I haven't mentioned our tech yet. That is because we are currently absent tech. I'm hot dogging it over here. So with any luck, this is going to be a song that I've been thinking about all week. And you know what? I've been thinking about all week just because it felt really appropriate. And then, you know, without getting into a topic that's entirely off topic, but I think is hard to completely ignore with the terrible news from last night from Nice. I just, you know, with lack of another option, I felt like I had to play this song. So I think you'll get why I've chosen it. And we may or may not come back to that in the bonus show. But at least you'll know where I'm coming from with this. And with fingers crossed that this will actually play. Hang on one second. That was a half-decent fade for my first try.
That was a good fade.
You're listening to The Green Majority on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Aaron Kaster, in studio with Deirdre and Stefan. And we're, of course, a broadcast live on CIUT 89.5 FM as a replay on a whole host of other extremely appreciated, I might add, community radio partners internationally, all across Canada, in the U.S. as well. We have international podcast listeners from all over the globe. I was going to say as far away as, but I think we pretty much circled it at this point. And, of course, our local friends here at Rabble.ca as well, which we very appreciate for helping promote the show as well. But now we're going to go back to Stefan, who's going to introduce what I guess we could call the international segment of the show.
Yeah, sure. Although we have a similar sort of thought on the third part of this as well. So maybe the rest might all be international. We'll see.
All right.
Maybe we'll come back. But at least we're moving a little south of the border, as we often do on this show, in part because, you know, climate politics in the States very strongly impact our policy here. And then also the fact that, you know, as one of the largest emitters, they're kind of important. In the same way that we cover, you know, whenever China or any of the other larger industries make compelling climate change cases, we talk about, you know, if Russia ever does, I'm sure we'll cover that, but I don't see that coming anytime soon. Although actually, if I can frame this section a little bit, Russia actually does come into it a little bit, in that I've been working through my head a little bit, which is whether climate change can ever become the issue of our time that activists for so long have declared it needs to be. And I've been thinking about this, and then the corollary to this is, if it can't, like if we're never able to make it salient to the level it needs to be the issue of our time, can we still win the battle against climate change without this case? And so the way this ties in to some extent, so let me give a premise of why I've been thinking about this, is that, you know, 6 months ago, maybe now 7 months ago, the largest international climate event, I could argue ever, occurred in Paris, and we had an agreement of 170, I think it's 5 countries signed on to tackle climate change. And if ever there was a time where everyone was talking about climate change, it was right around that. It was an actual conversation that everyone was a part of. It was mainstream news. It was a conversation we were having. And since then, so much has taken over the conversation. You know, there's been all of the, you know, there's like the ongoing national security conversation that exists around terrorism. There's been just the Donald Trump phenomena in the United States. There has been Brexit, Britain leaving the EU, which has, as an aside, we should probably cover that next week, about the climate change impacts of that. It could be enormous. Mm. There has been there's troop buildup on the NATO border with Russia, like there's all of these stories that have come up and have dominated the conversation in a way that the number of things people will think of if you mention climate change now, like it's been lost, I think. And that happens all the time. It's happened every single time climate change has risen to the fore. An example of this, which is a story we were going to maybe have to get to later, but I'm just going to mention it now, is that, you know, the Deepwater Horizon. There's another story right now about BP being charged another $2.5 billion for what happened in Deepwater Horizon. And again, and does anyone even remember that? Like, it's so, it feels so gone, so long gone, so not there. And so this, and then, you know, and so all of these things we keep losing and losing and losing. And I find such an interesting question that I have about whether or not climate change can actually become an issue over time. And so the way this ties into American politics is that we've now seen we now roughly know what the what both the Republican and Democratic national what the platforms brought to the conventions will be. The Republicans is a little wacky.
Can I summarize?
Yes, please.
They're lunatics.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you. Excellent summary. Yeah, the Republicans have a whole bunch of pieces in it that are just baffling. You know, there's they argue that pornography is a public health crisis in it.
Public health crisis. Yes.
Yeah. 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 They say the coal is clean on
clean by definition. Yeah. And let me be clear.
Yeah.
Let me be clear. They're not saying that we should pursue quote unquote clean coal as in a way to clean the technology to adhere to climate change. They are saying that coal as it exists is clean by definition.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Like, and also water is dry.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Darren, you had a great little pitch to me earlier today about the greatest example as to why coal is provable not clean. And if you want to quickly tell that story.
Oh, no, I forgot what you'll have to cue me.
The Glasgow.
Oh, okay. Yeah, just really quickly. So if you go to Glasgow, the most obvious effect you'll see of this is Glasgow. I was in Glasgow a number of years ago, and the EU had a fund where they go and they clean up certain various cities, and they give a city a bunch of money. And a number of years ago, it was Glasgow. And Glasgow is famous as an industrial town, or, you know, it was very involved in an industrial town. They're sort of early industrial cities. And was for many, many years, essentially the entire city is black. Every building, every surface, everything is black from the coal dust. And they started cleaning it, but they started at all the main floors. And then they ran out of money. And so to my knowledge, to this day, if you go to downtown Glasgow, the first story of all the downtown buildings is looks like polished new building, and everything above that is still black. It looks like somebody went and painted it. But no, that's the contrast between what happens when we burn coal willy-nilly and not. It's extremely visible. In fact, you can probably go to Google Earth right now and do Street View and look at it yourself.
Right, just drive through Glasgow virtually and see the black. Yeah. Like, I love that. Like, that's the clean. It's clean as long as you want everything to be black. If you want soot to cover everything, it's clean.
People like black.
There we go. but it's one of those things, right? It's one of those. It's just these.
Coal is the new black.
It's like, there you go. it's all of these things are this. How are we having this conversation still? Like, how on earth is that a part of the RNC platform that coal is clean just because we like saying coal is clean? That's not how the world works. At least we hope. But so to move on, and then on the flip side, the Hillary Clinton actually could end up running on the strongest climate change platform ever. And it won't be ratified until the convention. But climate activists are hailing this as a major win. Even though at the same time, Hillary's camp has gone out and said she doesn't support a carbon tax, which is in the platform. But it does also include a climate test for future pipelines and tighter rules on fracking. And fracking was the big fight actually at the DNC or at the fight over this platform. And a lot of this can be attributed, of course, to Bernie Sanders. He actually got a bunch of quite progressive people on actually to negotiate this platform. And so a lot of these victories actually can be given to him.
If we can actually pause there, I need to bring this back to Canada for a minute, which is because, you know, we just had an election a little while ago, of course, and a new prime minister, which is, you know, make no mistake, leaps and bounds better than the one we had before. But,
yeah.
You know, what we had essentially was people were so terrified of, you know, for a variety of reasons, terrified of Harper that we elected a supermajority Liberal government. And at the time, I was saying, and I will still say now, and I think Bernie Sanders, we have to keep in mind to keep this in the context of the American politics as well with what happened with Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders essentially took the Democratic Party hostage over his policies. And the reason he was able to do that is because his policies were incredibly popular, including among Republicans. Most of his key issues have something like 70 or 80% approval among all Americans, including Republicans. So what we need to take a lesson from this just really quickly is that we need to stop thinking that your choice about what the future of a country or the future of your province or the future of your town is by who you elect. No, you find someone who you think is going to be the most sympathetic to you and you hold them hostage politically for the things that are good, because on their own, they will never, ever push the envelope. They're
their job title requires them not to. They're in a helpless position. Stefan, the story I always prompt you to go back to with the guy whose name I always ask you who it is because I never remember.
Keith Stewart.
Thank you. I didn't even have to prompt you. You knew exactly what I was getting at about the guy going on about this long conversation with a politician about climate change. And he says, look, this is very convincing, but I don't have no votes to lose over this. What do you want me to do? We have to be aggressive. You have to, and of course, I mean politically aggressive. You have to be aggressive and go and hold them hostage and say, look, if you want my vote, here's my frickin' list of things I want, or you can go to hell, right? This is not a thing. And Bernie Sanders proved that. And for anyone sitting back and being cynical, okay, well, fine. Well, then get out of our way. Mm-hmm. The people that actually want to push for things and actually want to fight for actual progress, get out of our way or shut up or join us. Yeah. Because it is possible, and we just saw it. The effect that Bernie Sanders had on Hillary Clinton's platform is monstrous. Make no doubt about it.
Yeah, and that's interesting, right? He very much was fighting this this very interesting battle. And what's also interesting is that the places he won were places that the Democrats actually were willing to sort of accept. They were the people that she had under her tent were more willing to accept what's interesting is that theoretically Bernie Sanders lost on trade, quote unquote, and won on climate change, and it's because climate change is one of those things that really is creeping further and further into what a centrist policy is now take climate change into action. I think we'll slowly start seeing and then there's even movements in the states for Republicans who are support climate change action. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing that the climate change is actually one of those things that actually is moving across the spectrum to cover the entire thing. Which you see in a lot of it's sort of how progress is made, is that slowly but surely, it starts as a very, very left policy and slowly becomes all policy as it wins across the board.
And I think we should, well, let's come back to it on another show, but I think there's a very interesting discussion to be had there about the amount to which working together across quote unquote party lines is hampered by the attachment people feel to social issues over all else, right? So, and even I would feel extremely uncomfortable, professing cooperation with a group of, Canadian conservatives who say wanted, action on climate change, but still were like anti-choice and hated gay people. I don't know that I could do that. And that's interesting.
Yeah. And that's what's happening now, I think, especially with the evangelicals and Catholics in the States are now quickly becoming some of the strongest environmental advocates. The evangelicals because it was a way to actually get young people interested in God, and the Catholics because of the Pope. But both of them are now actually becoming quite strong environmental advocates, but the way they're trying to do it is still hampered exactly by social issues.
Any religious organization that wants to go around saying, God exists, but we have to do all the hard work, I'm totally in support of that.
But what's also interesting about the news about the U.S. politics and climate change is that a lot of, in some senses, this draft platform that's come out sort of codifies the changes that are undertaken in by Obama in his second term. And actually makes it harder for Clinton to sort of backtrack on those policies. Because Obama was very famously saying things like all of the above energy policy, we should just do everything. But since 2014, in his last 2 years, he's shifted from that and actually started coming down much harder on a lot of things. He restricted oil drilling off the Atlantic coast and mining in public lands. And earlier this year, he proposed the carbon fee in the form of $10 a barrel on tax on oil. Obviously, it's not huge, but these are things that sort of even in Obama's term, you've seen him actually change. And I think in part it's because he was unable to actually get some really strong legislation passed. And so he's like, well, what else can I do? And has come up with a sort of grab bag of policies to throw together.
He's gone around doing everything he can through executive action because the Republicans won't let him do anything.
Yes, straight up. Yeah. So what does, of course, lead to is this question of whether or not but what it is that this new platform, if accepted by at the Democratic National Convention, means that Hillary Clinton will have run on this kind of thing, which is only good news. Basically, it may not work, but it's at least better news than not having happen.
All right, so we've only got a couple minutes here left in the last section. Deirdre, why don't you take it?
I just wanted to come back with the point that you started on, Stefan, about whether climate change is going to become an issue of our time. And that's because I think Darren made a really good point when he said that politicians need to hear from voters. And I think that's difficult with climate change because I think a lot of people care about it, but I think it's always an undercurrent. And I think at this point, at least, there's always going to be something more pressing that's happening right now, unless you're an island nation, which we'll talk about later.
nice tea.
Excellent. But I think the issue is that it's always going to be an undercurrent. And unless we look at every different subject and look at the common factors in each subject, and climate change is always going to be one of those factors. It's always going to be in every issue that we talk about. But people aren't looking at that. And unless we start looking at that undercurrent, it's never going to be brought to the surface, and politicians won't think that the voters care about it.
Yeah, I think you're very adequately – that's the sort of the consistently always mentioned as the number one hampering of climate change, is that it needs to be a piece of everything rather than one thing, because it touches everything. And, you know, perhaps – and I think that's actually the way that it could simultaneously get solved and not become the issue of our time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if every single department was called, you know, Department of Finance and Climate Change, Department of Health and Climate Change, Department of this and Climate Change, it would never necessarily become the thing that everyone is talking about, but in all of the small ways, you would see the transition that we need required happening. Unfortunately, we still live in a world where, you know, the new Prime Minister of Britain just drops the Department of Climate Change entirely, which is sort of the opposite way we're going, and is part of my concern. But I think that is, I think you're right. I think that is perhaps the way we can you can move forward.
But Stefan, I'm sure that the new Prime Minister who elected someone like good old Boris there. To be
the foreign minister is called in Britain.
Yeah, essentially the head diplomat. I'm surely remove the department because it's silly when you're imbuing concern for climate change through all departments.
Oh, right, of course. Yes.
To give any single department undue focus.
Naturally, yes. I'm sure that's what it is. Even though the person that they put in charge of the environment, I believe when they entered the energy as energy a couple of years ago, the first question they asked is climate change real? But I guess they're asking the question, so that's a win.
Yeah, I'm gonna offend probably maybe about 40 people here, but I have a position, and this is slightly ignorant, I admit, but I don't think anyone named Boris should be elected to any office.
I guess I'm
40 people are really upset with me.
The
right
40 Borises. All I remember is the Rocky and Bullwinkle, and I think the evil guy's name is Boris.
All right. So another good way to get on this show as well is to also be friends with Stefan. This is a friend
or family members actually. This is my
family
cousin's
and friends. Family and friends of Stefan Hostetter.
Yeah.
So this is going to be the last music break I didn't mention because I didn't want to tease it before we played it was Selena Williams with "Kill Him with Kindness," and this will be Otto Manic. With Out of Town, as long as I can get it to play. Here we go, fingers crossed. All right, we are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Darren Kaster, in studio with Deirdre and Stefan. And we're also broadcasting on all of our wonderful and very appreciated community radio partners. If you're not in the Toronto area, you're probably listening to us on one of those, or on the podcast, which I may add, in case you didn't know, has some additional content. It is sometimes, in fact, I would say is usually about the environment, but not always. It's really just a chance for us to have a little bit of fun. We play around. Occasionally, there's some colorful language, which is either a promotion or a warning, depending on your age and personal tastes, and we do have a little bit of fun there, just a little extension on the show. So if you're not sick of us by the end of the program every week, please do download the podcast, especially, or if you miss anything. And of course, you can get show notes and links to all the news stories that we cover, every single one, I might add, because we show our work, Stefan.
Yes, we do.
On the website, with every post at greenmajority.ca as well. And is it too early? Can I tease that we're having a website update soon?
No, do it.
Soon. That's your deal, man.
Yeah, I know.
You're doing all the hard work.
That's true, but it's basically done. We can, right. You know, there's a couple of formatting errors in that right now. As you go down the list of contributors, the end just ends with a gigantic photo of my brother because it hasn't slid aside because I don't have a bio beside it. But beyond that, it's ready and rocking, ready to go.
I will take a picture of Dave over stock images any day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the rest of our team are stock images.
Dude carrying flashlight. Dude holding reader. Yeah.
Women laughing with salad.
Yeah. Speaking of other laughing women, Deirdre, would you kindly lead us in our next section?
As we kind of teased in the last section, And as most of you probably know, Pacific Islands and islands in general are those who are dealing with the brunt of climate change right now. And they're also the ones who are kind of ignored by the rest of the world a lot of the time. But a group of Pacific Island nations has recently decided to pioneer the world's first treaty to ban fossil fuels. This is a group of Pacific Islands formed in 2013 that just had a summit this past week.
Just to be clear, you mean the group, not the islands.
the islands themselves came together.
The group of people from each individual island.
Although, if the islands hung out, that'd be kind of terrifying, but also cool.
Came together in what was called the Pacific Islands Development Forum and decided that they were going to plan the first treaty that would not only look to ban fossil fuels across their nations, but ensure universal access to clean energy by 2030, which is actually not very far away. So it's a big step for them. And it's interesting because obviously they're the ones that are going to suffer most if climate change happens as fast as it looks like it's going to. So it might be an indicator of the future of what the rest of the world is going to have to do, and it might be a good idea to start now. but what was interesting is that the organization used to include New Zealand and Australia before it was the PIDF, but they reformed this group after Australia and New Zealand kind of sabotaged their decision to cut off the 1.5 degree increase in temperature. So the group no longer includes New Zealand and Australia and seems to be doing pretty well for themselves. But it seems to be a step in the right direction, and it seems to be a step that the rest of the world should follow, and they want the rest of the world to follow. So we'll see if that happens.
Yeah, and I think this is a great example of, you know, those who are being affected are the best at being like, hey, this exists. Hello, everyone. Yeah. This is a real thing. This is a thing we should pay attention to. And those of us who are living blissfully unaware could be like, eh, what do the Pacific Islands know about climate change? Sure, it's affecting them directly and is like, you know, to an extent where there are a few islands who will basically be underwater in the next, you know, like in the next 20, 30 years, even some of the really low-lying islands, and so this kind of action, like it's fascinating. I think it really shows the sort of the privilege that we have to not pay attention to this right now, right? Like when you're in Canada and 1 meter sea level rise is terrifying, but also doesn't necessarily feel real to you. Or you're in Florida and 1 meter sea level rise will actually mean the lack of Florida, but you still can avoid pretending that's the that's actually happening. You get this sense of you don't have this ability to really see what it really is, and the urgency is the Pacific Islands are so good at consistently actually conveying the urgency because it's really affecting them, and they are the people that we are endangering by refusing to do anything.
And has anyone tried to explain to the xenophobic Trump types all over the world that if they're scared about immigration, maybe they should prevent other countries from being completely submerged underwater?
But they're not immigrating yet.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yes.
That'll be their problem. Build a wall around the island, and then that's all you'll have, and you'll have a state on a wall.
Yeah, well, to be fair, a gigantic wall around the entire United States would simultaneously keep everyone in and the water out.
Yes, actually, well, we concede to that. As long as they also keep their military inside that wall, they can build a 500-foot wall for all I care.
Speaking of their military, what an excellent segue, Darren. I don't think he even intentionally did that.
Nope.
But in our ongoing coverage of the Pentagon paying attention to climate change.
More than anyone else in the U.S.
Exactly. It's the Pacific Islands and the Pentagon. If there are two people who care about climate change, it's the Pentagon and the Pacific Islands. So they are, again, it seems like every, I don't know, like 4 months, a new article comes out about how the Pentagon is preparing for some different piece of this, of climate change. You know, for like they included in their security briefings forever. They had an entire I think that at one point they gave the climate change its own security briefing because it was so important. They've started testing these fascinating things everything the Pentagon does still has this kind of dystopian piece to it because they're the largest military. So when it's things like, oh, they have a solar power aircraft carrier, you're like, so that's interesting, but also still terrifying.
That drops a new kind of solar power warhead.
Exactly. Yeah. But anyway, so Darren, you actually read this article a little better than I did.
I read it thoroughly, and one by one, the hairs on the back of my neck started to stand up. So this is both, there's two different angles. You might even say five sides to this story.
Oh.
I'm looking at the picture right now. I couldn't
remember. On a roll.
Exactly.
At least two of the five sides will be brought up now.
Excellent.
Just to not preclude my own metaphor. So one side of it is the cautionary tale. One of them is the ongoing story, as you just very accurately cued, of the fact that the Pentagon has been identifying climate change as among the top, if not occasionally the top, threat to geopolitical stability and specifically as far as the U.S. is concerned, the security of the U.S. and its allies for something like 15 years. This is not new news by any means. We've been reporting on it on this show for nearly a decade. Mm. But it's getting a little bit more intense. So literally, there's millions and millions of dollars being hired by Department of Defense research programs to fund university models around anticipating, preventing, and manipulating large-scale social unrest for the explicit purpose. I am not reading into this, neither is anyone else. This is directly in their language and fully frontally admitted for anyone that cares to read it, that they are anticipating a great amount of international, global social unrest due to the physical impacts of climate change. So what we're talking about here is basically they think that there's going to be a giant protests and war and violence everywhere because of the impact of climate change. So first of all, take that seriously, because they're not a bunch of hippie liberals. These are, you know, the same people that make their life off war. These are not hippies. First of all, the second angle to this is how they're going about doing that. So the first part is the cautionary tale, which is, hey, they're taking it seriously. This is how seriously they're taking it. This is not an exploratory committee. This is not like the NASA's small sub-program, which is the SETI program, the Search for Extraterrestrial Life, where, okay, we've got a few bucks lying around. This seems like a cool project. We might as well do it. No. This is a main focus of what the Pentagon is focusing on right now. So the first fact is that they're doing it. The second fact is how they're going about doing it, which is that if anyone read any of the releases from The Intercept or anything like that a little while ago, I'll see if I can dig them up if I remember for the show post. Otherwise, they're out there about the Five Eyes. And basically what it was a bunch of countries, including the U.S. and the U.K., sharing security information because they have a bunch of laws. Each of these countries has laws about using their own security, international security apparatus against their own citizens. So what did they do? Well, they just agreed to share. So the U.S. spies on the U.K., the U.K. spies on the U.S., Australia spies on each other, and then they just share the information, circumnavigating all of the laws that they themselves wrote. To a large degree. So not only does this include, you say, okay, well, yeah, if there's social unrest, I want people to do that because I don't want my house being looted and rioted. Except that once you start reading more and more into this, there's many, many, many concerning aspects to it. We do not by any means have time to get into all of it. So I'd like to highlight one or two that really jumped out at me. One of them, and one of the things that was identified in that piece about the release about the Five Eyes and that plan, was that the current state is not simply analysis and detect. It is not simply a matter of, you know, what they do with ISIS, where they, you know, they try and track down the Twitter accounts and use the geolocators, because sometimes those stupid people leave their geolocation tags on when they tweet, you know, pro-ISIS stuff, and then they, you know, go and track them down that way. This is a matter of infiltration. And so what they're doing and what they're pretty upfront about, as long as you go and read the actual information about it, is that what they're doing is they're looking for ways to analyze not just where these, so the groups, and that essentially there's a whole bunch of non-violent people that support violent people. And so what they're saying is, you know, there's a bunch of people who support a cause. Those non-violent people basically whip up the passions of a small group of them who then become violent. And so the way to anticipate these problems is to infiltrate nonviolent groups, identify people who are based on their psychological tests and all their analysis, and they're working with all sorts of mental health people. This is the same sort of stuff that we got into extremely morally questionable stuff when they were using psychologists to greenlight torture programs in the U.S. a few years ago. Is to essentially use these psychological tests to try and figure out, to the best of their ability, you know, who is most likely to become violent and who's most likely not to. And not just to use this information to report it to law enforcement, say, hey, watch out for these people. We may want to keep an eye on these people, but to actually influence the groups covertly from inside. So infiltrate groups like Sierra Club, infiltrate groups like Black Lives Matter, infiltrate groups, any sort of peace, any war, any sort of actual group, Tea Party groups, could be anybody. Nonviolent people that have not done anything wrong. And before they've done anything wrong, go in and use the people who they have identified as probably more sympathetic to the nonviolent, and use them to actually try and influence them so that they can use their credibility to influence the group and actually influence the outcome of what's going on. So this is the very definition of, you know, Big Brother government, right? And so on the one hand, there's a legitimate concern in the reason they're doing this, and we should be concerned about the reason they're doing it, because the reason they're doing it is concerning. Also be extremely concerned about what they're doing. Both of those things matter. We could easily do a whole show. I'd like to stop it there. Please read the article. If there's one article I ask you to read this week, please read this one. I will post it first on the news later. But I've talked for quite some time. We only have about 4 minutes left. Squeeze something in, Stefan?
I was going to jump off that very briefly, and just the idea that it's also nothing, like, this sort of idea is not really new. Organizations have been doing this sort of, like, the government has been doing this sort of thing for a very long time. There was a recent article about how, you know, CSIS, when they at some point in time created a violent white extremist group as a part of their plan to sort of, again, infiltrate this sort of stuff. It's the reason why this kind of action is so morally dubious is it gets to a point where the people who have infiltrated the group, it becomes questioned whether or not they are the ones actually making the group more radical or not. If they are trying, if the people who are in the group are trying to check or test whether or not the group is going to, like, who will become radicalized, their position in the group is often a piece where they are in some ways radicalizing the group in themselves. And so this is the government coming into a group which is currently peaceful, being like, hey, what if we weren't as peaceful? Seeing what happens, and then if it does, then they immediately arrest the group and disband it. Right. Even though none of, like, while they themselves were the ones creating this.
Yeah.
And it's, you see the same thing often in during protests. You know, there's a question of whether or not the protests become violent because the police have infiltrated people and they're the ones who actually start the violence to justify a stronger crackdown by police. Mm-hmm. And all of these little pieces are what makes this, difficult and very, very concerning, is because it comes down to sort of sci-fi trying to pre-crime kind of thing, yep. Right? You're trying to stop crime before it happens. So you're just trying to see who might cause crime. And while it's sort of you hear it and you're like, oh, well, that makes sense. You want to stop crime before it happens. That's a positive thing. But when you're actively being inside the group and doing this, it becomes incredibly morally dubious and very, very difficult to sort of parse out that as a safe or good idea.
Yeah. I mean, an imperfect analogy might be, you know, if you could say, people are less inhibited when they've been consuming alcohol, and doing hard drugs, let's say cocaine, is illegal, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, to find out who is a potential criminal, aka drug user, in our culture, we're going to send police out to go to all sorts of parties and offer people cocaine. Mm-hmm. And you could say, okay, well, if you accept it, then you're breaking the law. Yeah, but would they have been exposed to it? Would they have been pressured into it? The simple fact that eventually, under, you know, being pestered in a state of, you know, imperfect decision making, would they have otherwise made that crime? And that's not a perfect analogy, but it's pretty damn close.
And we have laws against that. That's entrapment. And whereas these other scenarios we're talking about is because it's, you know, it's behind the scenes or it's way.
All right, so we'll have to leave it right there for the bonus show. We're out of time. If you're enjoying this conversation, we'll keep it going in a couple of minutes, but we are done for this week's edition of the Green Majority. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see everybody next week.